Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I have had the great privilege of serving alongside of for many years in the course of that war, both in government and outside of it, is, I'm very pleased to say, our guest for a full hour, a very important conversation. He is Ambassador Henry Cooper, a man who has served his country in the uniform of the United States Air Force, served as a civilian in the Air Force as well in the Pentagon back in the day. He went on to a number of other very important positions, including serving as an ambassador to the defense and space talks under President Reagan, having served for a time as an assistant director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And then, if all that weren't enough, he became the first civilian director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization during the George H.W. Bush administration. He has, ever since leaving government, continued to contribute mightily to the public policy debate about national security, most especially drawing on his experience with the Defense Department, the military, nuclear deterrence, and not least, of course, missile defense, contributing mightily, among other ways, through the superb organization established by a mutual friend of ours, Lieutenant General Danny Graham, called High Frontier. Well, you get the picture. I could go on and on about Hank Cooper, but we're going to stop so we could hear from him a little bit. Henry Cooper, it's great to have you back. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. It's been a long time. We've been friends together, and we've seen a lot of changes in the world. And I want to especially say this morning, I know we're going to talk about other things first, but you know, it's good to remember Ronald Reagan's speech, you know, 35 years ago today, and our involvement in that world that he created, actually, I think was one of the prime movers in ever since.
Well, we're going to come back and deal with that at great length in the course of this hour, and thank you for your generous time. But I did want to talk about, first and foremost, the incredibly exciting news announced late yesterday by, of course, tweet from Donald Trump. Namely, that H.R. McMaster, a man I have criticized frequently, I think deservedly, as the National Security Advisor, will be laying down that position's responsibilities on the 9th of April, and they will be assumed by an old and dear mutual friend of ours, Ambassador John Bolton. And I just wanted to invite you, Hank, as a serious player in the national security arena yourself for decades, to just, you know, express your thoughts on what this change means, in particular, what a Bolton role in the national security firmament at this moment in time might portend.
Well, I think he will add a tremendous boost to those of us who are very concerned about, you know, our foreign policy issues, but also our national security issues. Frank, you know him better than I. I think you knew him as a young buck up on Capitol Hill as well. And, you know, he's been an active participant in our national security matters ever since. He's played important roles. He will be very knowledgeable on our issues and more to the point. I think, if I think for a while, I'll think of something I disagree with him on, I suspect, but because I have a hard time agreeing with everybody on everything. But in any case, I really look forward to John's addition, not only to activities within the White House, but as you well well understand, the National Security Advisor has a great open relationship with the if he has a great open relationship with the president, and I believe John will have that, will have enormous influence not only in his ideas that he presents to the president, but communicating the president's decision, and I'm sure you'll be loyal to the president and carrying out his wishes. And I think Trump's instinct in this field are dead on many issues that I care very much about. So I'm really looking forward to John's active participation going forward.
Yeah, Hank, again, let me take advantage of the fact that you have served in the senior most ranks of the U.S. government to just tease out that point, because I think it's so important. This is a man who is not simply advising the president day in and day out, the National Security Advisor, but he is an incredibly important traffic cop inside the cabinet for the kinds of policy recommendations you and I have both lived through. In fact, we've engaged sometimes on opposite sides, as I recall, but mostly on the same side, but engaged nonetheless in the internal struggles over policy within the various departments involved in national security affairs. And it just seems to me, having a guy who is actually on the president's side, working to manage the cut and thrust of the internal debates, is going to be a very important change from what we've seen for the first, roughly 15 months of this administration. What say you?
I completely agree with you, and I don't want to be super critical of McMaster, but I don't think he really lived in the world of foreign policy. Probably was a great soldier. I don't know him personally, have never worked with him, but I think he was a sort of a fish out of water on some of the key issues that the president really is responsible for, and John will be a welcome player, not only a player in the team, but to lead the president's actions within the national security interagency process. I don't know how they work now, but of course, when you and I were there, he chaired the what we refer to as the Principals Committee on all policy preparation, as well as the active division, principal advisor actually on all of national security matters to the president. So, I mean, he's really an important figure, at least in the bureaucratic order of the government. And we could spend a long time criticizing, the deep state, but still here, year and a half almost after the president has been on the job, and the need for his team to play not just at the very top levels, but also at the second tier levels across the government. And the running of that important bureaucracy is a primary responsibility of, it has been at least in the past, of the National Security Advisor. And so that's enormously important. It's just now that the key positions in the Department of Defense are being formed. We have two new undersecretaries in defense, both of whom are good guys and on our agenda. I think we agree probably 90% of the time, and that's going to be a great improvement over in DOD. And their activities will be a part of the preparation of those important issues going forward, and John Bolton will be orchestrating that.
Yeah, well, I did want to just pick up on that point, Hank, because I think you know as well as I, it is absolutely critical to the success of any presidency, to say nothing of, the National Security Advisor and the National Security Council, that he have the right people there. And it's important to have the right leadership in each of these agencies and at the NSC. But it's also critically important that the personnel, that fill those key positions. You've talked about some, I think you're right, very satisfactory appointments to senior positions in the Defense Department. But the National Security Council has been a disaster area, as far as I've been concerned. McMaster kept in place an extraordinarily large number of Obama personnel who simply did not agree with the president's policy proclivities. And I frankly think neither did McMaster. He may not have been all that deep in it. Of course, his reputation was that he was a great thinker on all these issues. I'm not so sure about that. But his judgment on a lot of policy matters, and certainly on personnel, left a great deal to be desired. I pray that one of the terms in which John Bolton is coming in will be that he will have a free hand in staffing up the National Security Council so that the president has not only at its senior ranks, but throughout, people who are willing to work to advance and help secure his agenda. Hank, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to turn to that speech you mentioned a moment ago, 35 years ago today. One of the greatest speeches in the national security history of this country, that made by President Ronald Reagan. Both Hank Cooper and I had the privilege of serving. We'll talk with him about that and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to say that we are joined on the 35th anniversary of one of the great speeches in American history, certainly in the national security history of the United States, by a man who was present at the creation, I think it's fair to say, in terms of the most important policy adjustments that Ronald Reagan sought in terms of incorporating for the first time in over a decade into the policy direction of our country, missile defense. I'm speaking, of course, of our guest, Henry Cooper. Ambassador Cooper served President Reagan in a number of capacities, including as his ambassador to the defense and space talks with the Soviet Union about all of these things. But Hank, I did want to just kick this off by asking you to reminisce with me a little bit about the speech that President Reagan made 35 years ago today, March 23rd, 1983. Where were you at the time, and what did you make of it?
Well, at the time, I believe I was in an interlude between having served in the Air Force as the Deputy Assistant Secretary overseeing our strategic and space systems and all their associated command, control, communications in that world. And for a short time, I dropped out of the government and frankly, during that period, did a special study on how on a number of things within the Defense Science Board and the Air Force Scientific Advisory Boards and that sort of thing. Actually, I did that all through the 70s. And one of the major issues that we had to repeatedly deal with while we were trying to figure out how to protect our Minutemen who were becoming vulnerable to the Soviet SS-18s and so on, was the missing role of missile defense because of the ABM Treaty of 1972. And so when I heard this speech, you know, it was music to my ears. The most effective way of defending the Minuteman that we worked on, cost-effective, was a preferential defense.
Hank, let me just tell you where I was at the time. I was working as a young staffer on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I remember looking forward to this speech with great anticipation because President Reagan was going to muster out and use his extraordinary communication skills and his political capital and his great authority, of course, as the commander-in-chief, leading what you remember, as do I, the Reagan buildup, as it was called, including especially our strategic nuclear forces. And he was going to weigh in on the MX missile controversy. We were talking about the Minuteman. There was a very, very concerted effort to build a new, much more capable missile than Minuteman III's and to base them in a survivable manner. And this was going to be the real shot in our arm. And lo and behold, in the last, three or four paragraphs, the president sort of veered off of that topic and onto how it was going to be better to look at whether we could defend American lives rather than avenge them. And this became, of course, the sole preoccupation of much of the defense community and the anti-nuclear protesters and the Soviets, of course. And it was off to the races from there. But I did want to ask you about some of the thinking. It seemed to some people that it was an afterthought, but to the contrary, he had given a lot of thought to the need for missile defense. I remember some of our friends and colleagues who staffed him in that regard, the late Bill Van Cleve, his first national security advisor, Dick Allen, Edward Teller, Lowell Wood, and the Joint Chiefs. Tell us a little bit about some of these folks and the influence that they had on the president as you understand it today.
Well, let me just say that one of the key people in all this, and I really appreciate the role of all the folks you've mentioned, was Danny Graham. And even before there was an SDI speech, I recall getting a book called High Frontier from an organization I didn't know anything about, which was called at the time the Heritage Foundation, which published it. And many of the people around the leadership of the Heritage Foundation were kitchen cabinet folk of Ronald Reagan. And Danny Graham then formed the High Frontier, and his job was to go out and find out whether the American people would be supportive of the kind of initiative that Reagan made in the SDI speech. At that time, I was in the Pentagon, I think even before I met you, and nobody over there thought that report made any sense at all. It was hard to find anybody among the folks there who did.
They had all drunk the Kool-Aid of the idea that mutual assured destruction was the natural order of things. So no missile defense for us.
Right. Missile defense. The only role missile defense was permitted to have was, to defend our silos, to help their survivability at one site.
Right. And this, again, is a function of the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And so you found no takers, and I think that was my experience, too. I came into the Pentagon shortly after the speech in August of 1983 and found myself responsible for trying to move this president's agenda along. And there was unbelievable resistance in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where I was working at the time.
Absolutely. And, the unsung heroes in the Pentagon in support of Reagan's views on this were the Joint Chiefs. I mean, most people don't know that, but for Jack Vesey and particularly Jim, the CNO, I'm having a mental block right now, but were great supporters. I talked to recently to Ed Meese, who was there in all of this, and Reagan and a few of his close advisors, everybody in the White House wasn't in on this either, thought that before he made such a speech, he should talk with the chiefs and see where they would fit. And he did. And they turned out to be supporters. They were among the very few people who reviewed that section that you're talking about before it went in and made comments on it. And Jim Watkins, in later years, he's the CNO whose name I was having trouble with a moment ago, reviewed that. And he was not only on board, he was a major advocate, particularly of space systems and so on, ahead of his time. The bureaucracy is finally waking up to that point today. But Reagan was 35 years ahead of his time when he made that speech.
And I think we do need to mention one other individual who played a big role in this. I had the privilege of working for him initially as a deputy assistant secretary, and that was Cap Weinberger, the president's Secretary of Defense at the time. And man, was he ever an enthusiast for what, as you mentioned a moment ago, the acronym SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, as it came to be called. Others came up with the moniker Star Wars. I think it was Teddy Kennedy to ridicule and demean and undermine it. Unfortunately, that name stuck a lot more than SDI did, as you know, Hank Cooper. But it did begin, really, with the exposure, as I understand it, of the president to this idea that mutual assured destruction simply didn't make any sense. As I recall the story, Dick Allen and Bill Van Cleve, I think, when he was getting ready to run for president, or maybe even was campaigning at the time, went out to the Strategic Air Command and was walked through sort of the scenarios in which the nuclear strikes would take place and so on. And he was just absolutely thunderstruck to discover that we didn't have any capacity to actually prevent those Soviet ballistic missiles, SS-18s or whatever, from reaching their targets here in the United States with absolutely catastrophic effect. And I think he set his mind at that point, with Danny Graham's help and Edward Teller's and yours, and others to fixing that. Hank, we have to pause for one moment. We'll be right back with more about what flowed from this presidential vision, how he overcame opposition internally, and what came after that that has helped shape our world today, with one of the men who did it, Ambassador Henry Cooper, the chairman of High Frontier, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with a dear and longtime friend of mine, Ambassador Henry Cooper. He has been the chairman of Applied Research Associates. He is a senior associate with a marvelous organization, the National Institute of Public Policy. He's been a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he has been, not least, the chairman of the board of High Frontier, the organization Danny Graham founded to try to champion particularly space-based missile defenses, because he understood so well the importance of that, as he called it, high frontier. And Hank, let's talk about that next, because I think this is a key piece that even today seems to be eluding a lot of policymakers, perhaps not so much the new Trump team, but certainly most of those who've been in senior positions since you left office as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under George H.W. Bush. The role of space, Hank, particularly for defending this country against ballistic missile attack, why is that such a controversial subject when it seems so straightforward and necessary?
I don't know. It's why is it so difficult? I think it's the legacy again of the ABM treaty and those who fostered this mutual assured destruction idea, and the notion that we would be most safe if we were vulnerable and simply relied on threatening our enemies by retaliation, which seems to be a morally corrupt idea in the first place. And I think that's the way Reagan viewed it. And when you start to think about serious defenses to protect everyone, and especially now that people are waking up to the growing vulnerability that we have to what's called hypersonic, super high speed maneuvering vehicles that initially are launched perhaps into the outer space area and orbit above the Earth and then come and maneuver through the atmosphere or maybe not even make it into outer space. And they can be launched from most anywhere. And now China and Russia are advancing those issues. Well, it becomes obvious when you think about this in just a few moments that the only sure way of building an effective defense against that is engaging in space to counter it. And that's becoming apparent. Now the commander of STRATCOM has essentially said the same thing. There are advocates again, and this isn't the first time, that there ought to be a separate space force, as they refer to it, separate from the Air Force, to be responsible for the coming battles in space and from space that are obvious to anybody who thinks very hard about this for some time. And that's just the technical reality of science moving ahead with things. And we have limited ourselves for all these years from building defensive systems. And that legacy lives on, by the way, because of the arguments of the past that to do this would be destabilizing, it would provoke an arms race and so on. And of course, the history of the Cold War, even with the SDI initiative before it was destroyed by the Clinton administration. The first thing they did was to take the stars out of Star Wars, as Les Aspin said, and not only kill the program bureaucratically inside, but they caused the dispersal of the technologists working those issues. Well, the Chinese have caught up with us now with the technologies that we were pursuing, and we're trying to reinvent it. And it's been... So that's why space is important.
Let me just ask you about one other piece of this, because it seems to me that at least at the rhetorical level, if not substantively, one of the other arguments has been that even aside from the anti-ballistic missile treaty and the sort of idée fixe that it became for the arms controllers and the left more generally, that that had to be preserved at all cost. It was the sine qua non of this avoiding the apocalypse in terms of threats to the United States and the Soviet Union that we're going to rely on, as you said, mutual assured destruction. But there was also this space weapons treaty out there too, and we always heard this argument, you know, so well from your days at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the late and unlamented ACTA, to my way of thinking. But this notion that space had been a pristine environment as a result of that treaty and mustn't be contaminated by having weapons there, even if they were not nuclear weapons, like, say, a program you worked on, which we'll talk about here in a moment, Brilliant Pebbles. But talk a little bit about that sort of theology and what the reality has been for decades, you know, going back to the first rockets about contaminating space with weaponry.
I've never understood the argument, and I don't know. I don't understand how it carried the weight that it carried in the public domain with, you know, the mainstream media, the whatever else, because it was obvious, seems obvious to me that when you build a defense against weapons, nuclear weapons, in fact, that are headed your way, and you intercept them in outer space, that somebody was there first threatening you. And so why we could talk about space as being some sort of sanctuary for our defenses against attacks that were coming at us through space, and that's been happening since World War II in the German invention of the V-2 rocket. So, I mean, this has been an absurd proposition. I started my career at Bell Labs working on defenses against that threat in the 1960s, early 1960s. And in fact, I helped design the only system we've ever deployed for homeland defense up until more the recent times. It was Nike Zeus initially, then Sentinel, then Safeguard, and it was not a very effective defense. But we've fought through all these. We've been fighting this issue since then. I mean, and it's an absurd proposition. Space is a place. I mean, it is not a sanctuary.
And as you were saying a moment ago, Hank, our adversaries have certainly understood that, and we'll talk more in a moment about all that the Chinese are doing. But just if you could, we're going to have a lot of time for this, but just very quickly, Hank, walk us through the physics of this. Why being able to defend our country, this vast, you know, 3,000-mile-wide landmass, to say nothing of Alaska and Hawaii as well, why it is simply the only practicable place to do this, particularly cost-effectively, is from space. And specifically introduce what you did during your time as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization with respect to actually building systems that could be deployed there to protect us.
We referred to the problem you're talking about as a global defense. And frankly, Boris Yeltsin eventually agreed with us. And one of the other great losses was when the Clinton administration came in, they cut off where we were in the discussions with the Russians at that time. It would be a bit different world today had those talks been completed. Boris Yeltsin actually agreed on an agenda, which included space, for our global defense. At the same time, he agreed to deeper reductions of offensive weapons, giving a lie to this argument that it only provokes an arms race. And I spent 5 years. This was Reagan's proposal, in fact, to go back to our theme for the day, that we find a way to cooperate with the Soviets and then the Russians to jointly protect the world community against this threat of ballistic missiles. The fact is that if missiles are launched, let's say out of North Korea, to the north to attack the United States, it doesn't fly over water, so you can't protect the nation from the sea if they're launched to the north from ocean. You know, from Aegis, it doesn't have that capability, and so we have these sites up in Alaska to catch them coming over the pole. But if you had a system in space, you could shoot them down even while they're rising from their launch pads and their rockets are burning and they're most vulnerable because anything you intercept a missile with there, the rocket there, will lead the rocket to destroy itself. We've seen that happen when we've launched satellites and had a failure. We saw it happen with the shuttle when the crew went down with Challenger and Columbia, whichever it was now. I mean, it's happened a couple of times. But during the launch, and there is a failure, in that case, due to an O-ring that froze, and the rocket destroys itself. So no other system gives you this capability globally to shoot down rockets in their boost phase.
Especially cost-effectively. Hank Cooper, we have to pause for just one more moment. We'll be right back with more on why the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty was such an impediment to this and why it was such a big deal when George W. Bush extricated ourselves from it. That and more with Hank Cooper right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our fourth installment of this extraordinarily important conversation with a man I've admired tremendously over a long time for his service to our country, both in uniform and in the civilian sectors of various agencies, including the Defense Department, and not least the work that he is about now as the chairman of a terrific organization, High Frontier. He is, of course, Ambassador Henry F. Cooper, better known to his friends like me as Hank. And you were talking before the break, Mr. Ambassador, about the extent to which your own work, that of defense science boards, that of the various analyses that the Pentagon did during my time, and more broadly, just the underlying physics all argue for having robust defenses against these threats, not just the North Koreans, not just the Iranians, these relatively small-time players, but the Chinese and the Russians as well, and how you could do all of that from space cost-effectively and quite efficiently as well, using, back in your time, the so-called brilliant pebbles technology. Talk a little bit about that, and then what's available to us today that could make that even more effective and efficient?
I appreciate you bringing up Brilliant Pebbles because, in my mind, it was the premier product of the SDI era on missile defense, which ended on my watch when Les Aspin took the stars out of Star Wars and canceled all of the space technology work that we were doing.
He, of course, was President Clinton's Secretary of Defense at the time.
Yes. When I tell this story, I can't help but begin when I was in Geneva and Edward Teller visited me on one of his many travels over there to work. And he said, "You've got to come to Livermore and look at some of the work that Dr. Lowell Wood is doing." And I, of course, agreed with Edward, who's been a longtime friend and colleague. He used to be a fellow who reviewed my work when I was a young buck at the Air Force Weapons Laboratory and so on. And so I went to Livermore and was very impressed with what Lowell and his team had done with what is called COTS, commercially off-the-shelf technology. And I think it's important to understand the point that this was then and now the same thing is true, that the private sector was actually pushing the envelope to the point where, for the first time, we could imagine how we would build space defenses that would literally be less expensive than the missiles that they are designed to defeat. And frankly, I can't do it because we don't have the time, but just to give you the notion, what everybody knows now because they have an iPhone like the one I'm talking on, at the time that was cutting edge technology in the private sector, and you could have an iPhone-like thing, no surprise now, that had the power of what was then called the Cray 1 computer, which is the fastest supercomputer available. And that became the brains of why it was called Brilliant Pebbles, the little tiny satellites. where each satellite knew where every other satellite in a constellation of thousands was, and what they were seeing as they looked down could be shared among that constellation. And basically, the idea was that like a massive system that works its own way, you could design who had the best shot, and not necessarily who, but whenever any of the pebbles decided to shoot down an attacking missile, as I said a moment ago, in its boost phase where it's being launched, you know, it would just shout to the rest of the constellation and it would figure out how to readjust for future parts of the battle. This was really cutting edge thinking. Everybody who watches the current movies now understands that that notion is a realistic one for many people. They go beyond what is now possible. But what I've described to you is what Brilliant Pebbles was about. And we were on the cutting edge. We had gone, it became the first on George Monahan's watch, who was my predecessor. It became the first of the SDI programs to actually enter a Defense Acquisition Board approved program for concept validation and demonstration, a so-called DEMVAL program. And that was what they killed.
Yeah, that's the thing. It was good to go about the time you left office, and it was terminated at that point. And we wound up pursuing rather, I think, inadequately, but nonetheless pursuing other kinds of missile defenses, notably a ground-based system. You talked about some of them being deployed up in Alaska. Others are now down in Vandenberg Air Force Base. I did want to call attention to one other program. You alluded to it earlier in this conversation, the Aegis sea-based missile defense system. And I was hoping that you might talk a little bit about work that we did together at the Heritage Foundation, as a matter of fact, where you spoke yesterday to commemorate this important anniversary of the president's speech, and a Team B initiative that you put together to tease out an important augmentation of those ground-based systems. Tell us about that, Hank, and where we are today with respect to the Aegis defense at sea.
I am most proud of our Aegis BMD systems, which began on my watch. And I can't take all the credit on this. Admiral J.D. Williams was my partner in this, and he was able to persuade the Chief of Naval Operations to take my money to begin the Aegis BMD program. And it had many of the features that we want in space, because most of the Earth's surface is water. So in most cases, missiles that are launched from almost anywhere fly over water. And what do we have at sea? Well, it turns out that Aegis systems are deployed around the world. So that was an enormously important thing. Then we were kicked back to zero. And the time period you're referring to at Heritage was in the 1994 time period. The House was won by the Democrats, Newt Gingrich's contract with America, and Lowell Wood again, and I went to Philadelphia to a meeting of all the incoming new Republican House and met with Jack Kemp and said, what we need to have is a Team B, and can you persuade your good friend Ed Faulkner to establish a Team B? And that's how it came to be. Faulkner agreed and set up this Team B, which I led for 3 years, actually, at the Heritage Foundation. You were a member. Mike Griffin, who I've already mentioned, was a member. And the bottom line was that we wanted a global defense, first from the sea and then from space. We knew we couldn't get space to space at the time because the cards, political cards in the administration, was against us. And the ABM Treaty was still, you know, at the top of the list. And we even couldn't fully develop Aegis system because the treaty blocked that too.
Hank, as people are listening to us, I suspect that they find this simply unbelievable, that we ever were in a situation where we couldn't protect our people against missile threats, enthralled to this idea that, as you've said, the Soviet Union, which had immense capabilities to destroy us, would be unimpeded by any protection on our part. When you talk about the president's vision, Ronald Reagan's vision 35 years ago, I think it's no exaggeration to say he was anticipating a situation like today, where there, whatever he thought was going to happen to the Soviet Union, we know he certainly wanted to take it down and did, but that there would be other missile threats, and notably from China, for heaven's sakes, to say nothing of North Korea, and to have no defense simply because we had some sort of arrangement with the Soviets or Russians that left us bare to or naked to all of these others was insane. I mean, hats off to him and, needless to say, to you for your work in this area. And we're going to finish up in a moment by talking a little bit about both the threat we're facing now and what we have got to be doing about it. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fifth and final installment of this extraordinarily timely and important conversation with one of the pioneers and real leaders in the whole area of national security, but most especially with respect to the necessity of protecting our country against ballistic missile threats, which now emanate not just, unfortunately, from the Soviet Union's successor, Russia, or for that matter, even communist China, but from others like North Korea, like Iran, and perhaps still others in the wings. Hank Cooper is our guest. He's been extremely generous with his time, and the corporate memory that he brings to this is unsurpassed. And Hank, I did just want to talk a little bit about what we need to be doing today, because we mentioned earlier that General John Hyten, who is today the four-star Air Force general commanding our Strategic Forces Command, or Strategic Command, has told just this week, on the eve of this anniversary, as it happens, the United States Senate Armed Services Committee, my old shop, that we have, quote, no defense, unquote, against the sorts of threats that are now emerging from at least the Russians and Chinese, these hypersonic and maneuvering systems that you mentioned. How could that be, given the incredible amounts of money that we have spent over the years, albeit some of it hamstrung by the ABM treaty? But what could we be doing that we're not now that might make a difference, even with existing systems that we have deployed?
Well, let me just say in introducing this, that because of the treaty and its focus on only ground-based systems initially, everything else was ground-ruled out. And the treaty, by design, forced us into a corner, which we've invested in the most expensive, least effective defenses around. And that's where we finally are. And frankly, some of the military late to the scene are beginning to understand that we can't keep up with adversaries who want to pursue technologies to defeat the sensors and systems that we have today. And the important thing to remember about space is what I emphasized a moment ago. It allows you to do boost phase intercept from anywhere. Before you get to that, there are other ways to shoot missiles down in their boost phase as well, including the hypersonic threat, in my view. We're not there yet. There's work to be done, certainly. But I brought this up in the Heritage meeting yesterday. Somebody asked, what can we do quickly? And that's really important. It's going to take a while to build the space systems we need, a few years, but still a while. So what can you do quickly? And I said, if our troops are prepared to go into harm's way, we can do it today. You can use AMRAAM, which is an air-to-air missile that some of our fighter aircraft carry, and you fly. You have to go into harm's way, and you have to be escorted. You can't. I'm thinking now about North Korea in particular, because you only have a limited amount of time to shoot something down while it's going up, and it'll be expensive. But you can do that. And soon as you can, if we're smart, you get into the business of deploying these kinds of interceptors on unpiloted air vehicles, or now they call them remotely piloted vehicles, because somebody sitting out in Nevada can actually control, the UAV that's flying over somewhere else. So any case, that technology is around and can be exploited and developed to be exploited today. You could deploy the MRAM almost immediately, but you'd have there's development on the other. And you've got to deal with the issue that of maneuverability. And that's an issue, as you and I know, we've been wrestling to get people to address properly for many years. And I don't know what they're doing inside the system, but if they're not addressing that problem, somebody's butt ought to be kicked pretty hard.
Well, specifically, just let me mention, Hank, that the thing that may be a game changer in this regard is if we can use a what's known as a predictive algorithm that can enable even perhaps the rather rudimentary systems, relatively rudimentary systems we have deployed, whether at sea or most especially on the ground, to maneuver to be where those maneuvering systems are going to be. It's kind of the Wayne Gretzky approach of going to where the puck is going to be, not where it is. And I'm very keen on this, and I know we've been working together to try to make sure that this is something that hopefully a John Bolton coming in will take a fresh look at, as well as the Pentagon's Ballistic Missile Defense Review. They have one predictive algorithm we know of that has been tested and seems very promising, known as the hypersonic intercept technology, and I'm very keen to see that validated if we can, and then, you know, thereby give us some options, as well as build into the system the space-based capabilities that that you're so clear are needed. Speaking of which, Hank, I did want to just mention before we finish, what are the other folks doing in this regard? We've talked at some length about the strategic offensive capabilities. Are you seeing signs that the Russians and Chinese are pursuing strategic defenses as well? And to what extent might that bear on the effectiveness of our deterrent?
I have not engaged people behind all the green doors on this issue, so I am not knowledgeable of precisely where we are. You know, I mentioned earlier that we basically killed the Brilliant Pebbles idea. That technology was transferred by way of a company in Great Britain, Surrey, who invented small satellites early on to the Chinese now 15 years ago. And while we were precluded from doing anything on it by our own stupidity, is in my judgment, and now we see evidences of the Chinese deploying lots of little satellites. They certainly understand how to work the computers and so on. They have our technologies there. So I can just see from what's going on from obvious out in the world and the reports that everybody can read on the web now of these small satellites. And DARPA has got a major program in this area that you can read about as well. So the technology is there, and there is no ownership on that technology. It depends on the smarts. We've educated the Chinese scientists. They come to here, and they used to want to stay here. Now they want to go back to China, I am told, because China gives them more opportunity than they can get in the United States.
And part of this is in part the utilization of those skills, some of which we've honed in our graduate programs and technology labs and the like, to build the threat against us. So this is very important. Hank, we are just about out of time. I did want to just close by both thanking you for the extraordinary contribution you've made over all these years to such missile defenses as we do have, and the leadership that you've been providing throughout to try to make it be all that it can be, as they say. I think there's just no getting around it. What President Reagan envisioned in his day, 35 years ago, most especially today, was a world in which we actually could protect ourselves against these sorts of threats. And I think he'd be chagrined to see that we haven't got more to show for it all. And I wanted to close by noting, you talked about our friend Danny Graham and the work that he did trying to assess whether the American people wanted missile defenses or not at a key moment. We've done a lot of work in that space over the years as well at the Center for Security Policy. And what I kept discovering was the American people thought we had a missile defense, and they were rather pissed off, actually, when they discovered that we didn't at the time, or certainly don't have as much as we need. So for all these reasons, your continuing service now with High Frontier and in so many public outlets is so vitally needed and so deeply appreciated, as is your time with us this hour. Hank Cooper, God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.